As mentioned earlier by Dr. Vanook, Dr. Lee Ellis was the discussant of the NSAVP's CO8 adjuvant trial of bevacizumab at the ASCO meeting, and I met with Dr. Ellis to obtain his perspective as a surgical oncologist on where we are in clinical research in the field in general, and specifically his reaction when he first saw the CO8 data.
I agonized as I prepared my comments for ASCO plenary because I think that's very important. And I was very intrigued by the fact that at that early time point, with relatively few events at that time point, it was quite an impressive hazard ratio. So in my own mind, I don't really think that we should be doing trials where the proposed hazard ratio endpoint is anything greater than 0.75. So when you see a hazard ratio of 0.6, you say, wow, this is really on the other side. This is really significant. So I think there was some interesting biology early on in the COA trial. But the issue is, what happens at 2 years, at 3 years, at 5 years? Do you continue bevacizumab long term? And what happens if you continue bevacizumab long term? So here we are in Florida. I trained at University of Florida. I had a wonderful chairman, Ted Copeland, who was a brilliant man who put things in simple terms. And he said, what you make on the peanuts, you lose on the popcorn. So we may gain a 3% benefit in disease-free survival if we continue the bevacizumab long term, but there's going to be some toxicity that you have to pay for.
I heard you and Axel Grothery were in the back of our symposium the next night at ASCO, where Norm was there. And we had, as you know, some breast and lung and Alan Vanook from colon. And I mean, Norm was totally on the defensive against the rest of the faculty there. So I think a lot of people sort of saw things the way you did.
It was an interesting symposium. And it's good to get people on the outside looking in because, of course, there are adjuvant trials in breast and renal cell, et cetera. And it was interesting that people said, look, this trial was set out to define a hazard ratio. I believe they had sought a hazard ratio of 0.8 or 0.75, and the boundary was crossed, and this was a negative trial. There was a biologic insight that was provided by this data, and I discussed this in my comments, that clearly the drug is anti-angiogenic, perhaps prevented or delayed the angiogenic switch in metastasis, and based on preclinical studies, there is an angiogenic switch in hepatic
metastasis.
But could
this also just been somehow synergy with the FOLFOX?
Well, if, again, I go back to the issue that you're really looking for cure in the adjuvant setting, and since we did not see more cures, eventually those curves came together.
I'm just wondering, in terms of what was going on, could it have been instead of anti-angiogenesis? And of course, you and I have talked about this so many times, the idea of, in a way, I'm not sure how that could happen microscopically, but of somehow facilitating delivery of chemo even in a micrometastatic setting? Or is that not logical?
For a micrometastatic disease, you probably don't need facilitated delivery of chemotherapy. And we could discuss this in more detail, but actually the proof that you're delivering more chemotherapy to a tumor when you add Avastin or sunitinib or any of the other drugs is really lacking in the clinic. In fact, if you look at all of the imaging studies that are done as biomarkers after initiation of anti-VEGF therapy, none of them show an increase in tumor blood flow, either at early time points at 2 days or at 28 days or 56 days. So we have a number of theories about how Avastin may augment the effects of chemotherapy, but none of us truly have the answer.
What about VEGF TKIs as an anti-angiogenic approach? The agent I hear a lot about is cediranib.
Cediranib is a potent drug. The generic name, well, of course, is cediranib, but prior to that, it was AZD2171. And it is much more selective for the VEGF receptor, tyrosine kinase receptors, VEGFR1, VEGFR2, and VEGFR3. There are three trials called the HORIZON trials, which have been initiated in colon cancer. And HORIZON 2 and HORIZON 3 are two trials in the frontline setting. I would need to look up some of my notes, but both the HORIZON 2 and HORIZON 3 trials have fully accrued, and now we're waiting for the results to come in. One trial is carried out in the United States, which is a direct comparison between FOLFOX plus bevacizumab versus FOLFOX plus cediranib, because in the United States, patients are going to demand a biologic since it's available. In Europe and other countries, bevacizumab may not be approved at this time, so it's reasonable to do a clinical trial with chemotherapy plus or minus cediranib, and that's being conducted in other parts of the world outside of the United States or where bevacizumab is approved.
What about the safety profile of cediranib versus bev?
There was an intermediate evaluation, of course, for safety, and the 20 milligram dose of cediranib was found to be safe.
Is hypertension proteinuria?
Cediranib gives you hypertension. Interestingly, there was a nice study published in Clinical Cancer Research a couple years ago by Steve Wedge, because we've had discussions around this table as to whether or not hypertension is a surrogate marker or should you treat to hypertension. And then the question arises, if you use an antihypertensive, would you reverse any benefit that you get by dose escalating to hypertension? And Steve Wedge did a preclinical study in mice treating mice with cediranib until they achieved hypertension and then using antihypertensives, all of the common antihypertensives that are used in humans. And that did not have any effect on the efficacy of the drug in mice. So the bottom line is it may or may not be good to treat the hypertension, but you definitely need to treat the hypertension in patients, and it should not limit the efficacy.
So you mentioned BRAF, and about a year ago I interviewed Keith Flaherty, and that was an experience just listening to him for an hour and a half. But and of course, he mentioned the trials that were going on in melanoma looking at BRAF inhibitors, and then had that really spectacular presentation at ASCO that shows some really encouraging data. What about BRAF and BRAF inhibition in colon cancer?
I think BRAF is an excellent target. BRAF is mutated in approximately 3 to 15% of colon cancer patients. Interestingly, if you have a KRAS mutation, you don't have a BRAF mutation. And if you have a BRAF mutation, you don't have a KRAS mutation. So they're exclusive. In some early studies from Australia, it was shown that if patients had a BRAF mutation in their tumor, they did not respond to anti-EGFR therapy. So then the question arises, well, how do you treat these patients, which comes back to your question. There are BRAF inhibitors, of course. Sorafenib was designed as a RAF inhibitor, although it really doesn't have great activity against RAF. But with BRAF mutations in colon cancer and melanoma, there appears to be a hotspot, which is V600E. Right. And the vast majority of mutations occur in this hotspot. There is a BRAF inhibitor which specifically is targeted to the V600E mutation, and I actually think that would be an outstanding clinical trial for patients who have the BRAF mutation in colon cancer.
I think actually there were two or three thyroid patients with BRAF mutations in Keith's presentation, but I didn't see any colons. So I guess it hasn't really been looked at yet from what I could tell.
At MD Anderson, we're doing a personalized cancer therapy program, and Scott Kopetz is leading the charge in colon cancer. And we are just initiating those trials, but one of the arms of the trial is looking for patients with BRAF mutations utilizing the Plexicon Roche BRAF inhibitor.
Interesting.
In that setting.
I want to get your take also as a surgeon on the issue of resection of hepatic-only metastases in colorectal cancer and all the controversy that's arisen there, particularly about the issue of pre-op versus post-op therapy. I spoke to Nick Petrelli. It sounds like the NSABP is launching a trial. It looks like it's going to really get off the ground looking at that. What's your take on all that?
Well, this, as you mentioned, it remains controversial, and I have two patients who came in over the last couple of weeks, both presented with the locally advanced sigmoid colon cancer and liver metastasis, and one's getting neoadjuvant chemotherapy and one is not. So even within my own practice, there may be little nuances which tell me which way to go. It may have to do with the age of the patient, may have to do with the location of the tumor. I don't think there's any hard data right now to suggest that the neoadjuvant chemotherapy is a benefit, but I do want to recognize Bernard Norlinger's wonderful European study showing that chemotherapy, both in the neoadjuvant setting and the adjuvant setting, provided a 9% improvement in disease-free survival compared to no chemotherapy at all. But we are unable to sort out at this time whether the benefit came from the neoadjuvant chemotherapy or the adjuvant chemotherapy, and I think that needs to be sorted out in the NSABP trials. One thing, just to expand upon that, one issue which was of interest years ago is the fact that people were afraid that the neoadjuvant chemotherapy would cause liver damage and make it much more difficult for the patient to recover. And that data came from Nick Vogt from MD Anderson Cancer Center and published it in JCO, but there have been a number of other studies that have been published since then showing that as long as you don't give very long-term neoadjuvant chemotherapy, that the patients seem to do just fine. the perioperative mortality is not greatly increased, and I believe this was also shown in Bernard Norlinger's study as well.
I think your group has also published work looking at the issue of bevacizumab and, again, wound healing in the setting of resection of hepatic mets. And actually, Nick said that this trial is going to have Bev in it, both in the pre-op arm as well as the post-op arm. What do we know about that?
Well, there have been several studies from Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, Duke centers, which have excellence in hepatic resection, and they have not shown an increase in the postoperative morbidity or mortality following bevacizumab in the neoadjuvant setting. But I will mention that in the Duke study that was published now a couple years ago, the p-value for complications was 0.06. And that was on 39 patients. So even though that's not statistically significant, we know that these are observational studies and retrospective analyses and do not necessarily reflect a larger patient population as Bernard Norlinger had done in a prospective randomized fashion just the way it should be done. So I think that all of us at these centers are very aware of the potency of the bevacizumab and anti-VEGF therapy. And most of us tend to drag our feet a little bit in bringing the patient to the operating room. So there was a European trial conducted by Grünberger where they would operate 5 weeks after stopping the bevacizumab and FOLFOX. And my question would be, why do you have to operate so quickly? Why put the patients at risk? And they didn't find any increase in complications, but we all feel that if you operate within 5 weeks of bevacizumab, there's plenty of bevacizumab on board, and you're probably better off waiting. We use a minimum of 6 weeks, but I currently use 8 weeks before I take somebody to the operating room who's on bevacizumab. There was an anecdotal report, a letter to the editor in Annals of Oncology, showing 4 or 5 patients where they stopped the bevacizumab, and in that interval prior to surgery, the patient's tumors grew. But I state that this is a letter to the editor and not a peer-reviewed publication or a prospective trial, and most of us really have not seen that, quote, rebound effect when you stop the bevacizumab.
Another surgical issue I wanted to ask you about is, as you just referred to with your patients, the people who present with primary tumors and metastatic disease. And there was an interesting presentation at ASCO by the Memorial Group. And there's also, I guess, an NSABP phase 2 study looking at these patients. And the whole question of if the primary is asymptomatic, can you just go ahead and use systemic therapy and maybe get the patient through, I guess, to their death without having to go through that surgery?
Yeah, you bring up a good point. And just over the last 2 weeks, there were 2 papers that came out on this topic. One was from the Sloan Kettering group with Pat Patey, a surgeon there, who published his findings in JCO. And in that paper specifically, they stated that only 7% of patients who didn't have surgery up front eventually had to go to the operating room. 93% of the patients never needed to have a surgical procedure when patients presented with an asymptomatic primary and metastasis. And you're right, you can get them through, unfortunately, to death without putting them through an operative procedure. And this really becomes an issue when you have somebody who has a rectal cancer where the surgery is not quite as straightforward and certainly prone to more complications. You'd like to avoid having to do surgery in that population if you don't have to do it.
I had another of your colleagues, Eric Jonash, in here a couple weeks ago, part of our renal cell think tank, and I was trying to convince them, you know, maybe in the era of all the new renal drugs, do you want to relook at the issue? Do we really need to be taking everybody's kidney out? Who, same kind of presentation, but I couldn't really convince them to get interested in that.
Yeah, I don't think you would convince them of that. I think people believe that there's some immunologic effect that occurs, but I'll leave that to those specialists.
I just wonder, though. I mean, the principle is, when I first heard about the NSABP trial, I thought, wow, what a great idea. I mean, it's very different. I mean, this is really a palliative trial when you stop and think about it, but I think a pretty noble effort. If somebody has to die of a disease, to be able to avoid having to go through that experience seems like a really worthwhile thing to do.
Yes, I think it is important to a surgeon, and this is where I think the new training system fails, the 80-hour work week, et cetera, because the fellows and the residents don't get to clinic. And what they'll see is they'll see Steve Curley take a patient to the operating room and do an outstanding case, and they're all very happy with that. What they didn't see is Steve Curley in clinic deciding that this patient doesn't need to go to the operating room. And I think you only learn this by being in the field for a number of years. But if you can save a patient a big operation and get them on chemo quicker, have them spend more time, more quality time with their family and not in the hospital, and of course, we're right in the middle of the healthcare debate with the new administration, and the costs of this are also enormous.